Welcome to Data Science Perspectives. This series focuses on analytics and data science professionals from across industry to learn about how their career unfolded, what skills they look for when hiring, and what trends they think are coming next. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Let's get to it. Welcome to this episode of Data Science Perspectives. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Today, we're going to be joined by Joe DeCosmo of Innova International. Joe and I first met probably about 10 years ago through the International Institute for Analytics. And for many years, we saw each other multiple times each year through the analytics leadership program that he participated in and that I was also a part of. He's one of those people that when you first meet him, you just know he's both smart and a nice person. As with many people of our generation, he began his career in the early days with roles at major direct marketing agencies such as Donnelley Marketing and Rapp Collins. He then founded and ran his own consultancy for more than a decade before selling it to the Elant Group and then serving first as their VP of Analytics Solutions and then as the Executive Vice President of Strategy and Analytics Services. For nearly 10 years now, Joe's been the Chief Analytics Officer for Innova International, and he recently also became their Chief Technology Officer. Innova creates custom credit models for people who have slightly below the typical credit score in order so that they can lend to them effectively. Joe helped lead the team from a startup mode to a publicly traded company via an IPO several years back. He also serves on several advisory boards and has a BA in economics from Lewis University near Chicago and an MA in economics from the University of Illinois, Chicago. And with that, let's welcome Joe to the show. Thanks for joining me on the show today, Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. It's great to see you.
What I'd like to start with is everybody comes from a different background into the world of analytics and data science. And I know you started academically with an undergrad and master's in economics. So how did you end up over in the world of analytics then as you began your career?
Yeah, it's a good question. So my degrees are in economics, but my graduate study was focused on econometrics, which is basically statistical modeling and forecasting for economic statistics. And so so that was really my focus, very heavy modeling and analytics focus in my studies. And while I was attending graduate school, I was also working at Argonne National Laboratory in their Energy and Environmental Services division. And I was doing various electric utility forecasting models, emissions forecasting models, and the like. And so that's really when I got my taste of the practice of analytics and data science as well. And then I moved into pricing early in my career, pricing models and demand forecasting models for the phone company for the first few years of my career as well. So very heavily modeling and analytics focused back in the late 80s, early 90s to age myself here.
Well, aging us both here, I guess I'll throw us in the same bucket. Our generation of analytics folks mostly went through at least some stint in what was then the hottest area of direct marketing. It might have even been still called database marketing back then when that was a new thing. I know you did as well with a couple of different companies. What did you learn during those jobs that you've been able to carry over throughout the ensuing years?
Yeah, so for sure. So I you know, after couple of years at Argonne, 3 years in telco, I moved into marketing analytics. So as you shared in my bio and background as well. So yeah, focused on direct marketing models back in the day. That was really, to your point, the sort of epicenter of marketing analytics back in those days in the early to mid 90s. The things that you know, I learned then that are still applicable today are, you know, it's funny, I think back to, you may remember this, it still exists, but the CRISP DM model for analytics and model building, it's actually still updated today. But the whole process of identifying a business problem, coming up with a potential solution or model for that, identifying the data you need, building and testing an algorithm, and then deploying and measuring the results of that. That still applies today. I mean, we would do that process for, direct marketing campaigns over the course of, months. These days, the difference is, we do that process, likely over the course of weeks. And the models we build are more sophisticated. The amount of data we're looking at is larger than it was back in the day. But those basic concepts still apply, right? Regardless of whether you're building a, machine learning model for credit risk or a response model for a, direct mail or online marketing campaign.
You mentioned an important concept there, which I agree with, and it's that, crisp DM, on the one hand, you could argue it's fairly simplistic, et cetera, and how can it still be relevant after all these years? But at the same time, I mean, really, it encapsulates and captures what the process is, those high-level steps. Just because you're using different data for a different purpose and it's a different algorithm than we used 20 years ago doesn't mean that you're not effectively following that exact same process. And I think a lot of folks feel like the process has changed over the years. I don't know that it's the process, it's the data and some of the algorithms that we're applying. What do you think?
Yeah, totally agree. The other thing I would say is that the other thing that hasn't changed in the last, 25 years of data science and analytics is that, in any modeling project, predictive analytics project, you still spend the majority of your time gathering and prepping your data. That the act of building the final algorithm, estimating the final model is many times the last, 10% of the work. And the 90% of the work is the collection and data prep. That hasn't changed. I don't see that changing, even as we get more sophisticated in our data.
Well, one time you did make a big change, though. You actually left the corporate world for a while. And I've always respected people who are able to do this. You started your own company. And many people try that. And most of them fail, but you managed to grow your company for 10 years and then actually sell it. So what led you to take that gamble? And then what did you learn through the process of growing and then eventually selling your company?
Yeah, so there wasn't, necessarily a big business plan behind my decision to start DeCosman Associates. I had during graduate school, I had sort of given myself a personal goal of starting my own business by the time I turned 30. And I literally incorporated DeCosmo and Associates and launched the business 2 months before my 30th birthday, the summer of 1995. So that was the extent of my business plan. At the start, it was just me. I was a one person operation for the first year, and then focused on building up a book of business and starting to add some staff. I mean, it was never a big company, so we got to about a dozen employees at the end. Very successful small business. And after 10 years of doing that, decided I was ready to, be part of a larger organization again, which was when I started thinking about selling and decided to sell to a client of mine, the Elant Group, which had been a client for 9 of the previous 10 years. So I joined a company that I knew pretty well. as well, and it helped them build up their analytics capabilities.
That's good. I guess that that partially answers what, another thing I was curious about, which was, as you go from your own company and being your own boss for about 10 years, you go back to being an employee. You know, what was that transition like, and how did that impact how you went about analytics, if at all, when you're working for someone else again, as opposed to yourself?
As I said, you know, the transition wasn't that jarring, because it was a company that I knew very, very well, right? I'd known the leadership of the company for the previous 9 years. I knew what I was joining, and they knew what I was bringing to the table. So that transition wasn't that difficult. I would say the big change was, you know, right off the bat, a bigger team. So I took, you know, most of my employees with, but then took on their analytics staff as well. So managing a larger team. The approach to analytics didn't really change that much. You know, I had already been at the table with them building out their analytic capabilities the previous 9 years. So that didn't change all that much. But then obviously the access to a broader and bigger client base, and bigger programs was the other nice change. Other than that, you know, I was happy to have, you know, rephrase, I was happy to not be responsible for, you know, office leases and health insurance and payroll and all those things as well. So it was nice to be, it was fun while it lasted, but it was nice to be able to focus back in on the analytics work.
Well, you've been at Inova now for about 10 years. So maybe I'm sure a lot of listeners might not be familiar with Inova, even though you're a public company. Maybe give a little bit of overview of what Inova does, so and how analytics comes into that.
Yeah, sure. So Inova is a financial technology company. So we are actually approaching our 20th anniversary from when the founders first launched the company. That'll be next year in 2024. But also we're approaching our 10th year as an independent public company as well. Next year. So Inova is, we're a financial technology company. We are an online lender, and our mission is to provide fast and trustworthy credit to consumers and small businesses here in the US and then in select markets around the world. And we do that through a very sophisticated technology and analytics platform. So we're essentially an e-commerce company. That's how we operate. We have no physical branches or stores, and all of our customers interact with us through our online channels. We have a collection of 7 brands, three consumer brands, and four small business. I'm sorry, 3 consumer brands, 3 small business lending brands, and then a payments company that we acquired a few years ago as well.
So when you moved over to the public company, especially one in an area like lending, which is somewhat regulated, right, and dealing with businesses and consumers, what did you find was different? You know, we talked a little bit ago about ChrisDM and how there's some pretty standard modeling processes. What did you find the difference was in working for a public company in this kind of a space in terms of the types of risk management or governance and other things that you had to do that maybe in the past just weren't as important?
Yeah, you've hit on most of it. So we've always been, you know, when prior to becoming a independent public company, we always been and are to this day both state and federally regulated. So So to your point, you know, consumer and small business lending and credit are highly regulated industries. And so, you know, we make sure that we are compliant in everything that we do in our in all of our practices. Having said that, you know, going public, it really made us not change the way we operate, but be much more deliberate about having our processes well documented, well understood, available for our, you know, stakeholders and board members and everyone else to review when need be. So it really brought a level of discipline to our business that didn't change the spirit or the way we make decisions, but the way we make sure that everything is documented well, that we've got good practices and controls around the decisions that we make. That's the big difference. And I think we've struck a really good balance between how we impose that that structure on Enova, but also keep the sort of agile, entrepreneurial spirit alive as well within the business.
So as you've spanned things from agencies to your own company to public companies, what are some of the skills or traits that you personally have that you think have been most instrumental in helping you succeed across all that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of it is just being open and willing to take on new experiences and challenges. That's probably been the biggest thing in my career. Even going back to my, you know, the first 10 years of my career before I launched to Cosman Associates, you know, I took a few job changes during that time, and they were either lateral or in one case, actually a step backwards in level, but, and pay. I've had taken some pay cuts along the way here, but I did it to build sort of skills and experience and broaden the experience that I have in different, whether it's a different industry or, you know, a different team or type of team to work with. And then obviously that led into my 10 years with the Cosman Associates as well. So I think that probably more than anything else, I mean, I haven't written code or built a model in 10 years. So, you know, we have, I'm not going to tell you that today it's my, you know, data science skills that distinguish me, but I think it's the ability to take on new challenges and experiences and then figure out, you know, best ways to solve them. And I always like to say that, you know, the question I ask these days is less, you know, how do we solve a particular challenge that we're having? And it's more who can solve it on the team, right? Who's the best person equipped to solve that problem? And so the focus changes a lot more people oriented from the what and how to who can do that, who's best suited to do that.
I find it interesting, you know, when you mentioned you even took a pay and level cut at one point to build out your skills. I think that's a good lesson for especially young people in their career to think about, which is a lot of folks try and optimize their level and pay at the moment, each step. And that can work, but you also run the risk of almost getting yourself so specialized in this one area that you can keep moving up in a little niche. And then at some point you decide you're not a fan of that niche and you don't have as many places to go versus taking that more strategic approach that you did. I'm going to build this broader skill base, which in the long run will hopefully lead you to, you know, higher level, higher paying jobs. But it takes a little bit of both hard work and a little bit of faith to take those what at this time seems like a cut.
Yeah, I advise students today. You noted in the intro, I'm active on some advisory boards here in Chicago, and whenever I talk to students that are starting their careers, I always tell them that, like, don't trade, a little bit of salary and a title for skill. Really, three things: skills, skill development, new experiences, and network, the ability to make connections, early in your career as well. And that, you're much better focusing on those things in your first, say, 10 years than you are in focusing on salary and title. I tell my daughters that, are, I have two daughters that are, out of college now. I advise them that. I advise, the students that are graduating, those things as well. I'm not sure they always listen, but I think it's pretty important advice.
That's really good advice. And as part of that explanation, you mentioned, that you serve on some advisory boards and all, and serve as a mentor to students. I know not everybody who's senior in their career does that. So what made you decide to get involved in some of those give back activities? And then what have you gotten out of it yourself? Because, I know I've done similar things. I know people who do it love doing it, even though some other folks just can't understand why they would.
Yeah, I mean, I started honestly when I launched DeCosman and Associates, I started getting active in at that time really industry groups, local and national industry groups first. And to be honest, I did that because as a small business, things can get a little bit lonely, and so having building up those connections through those organizations that I became involved in, through board memberships, and ultimately in some cases I became president of a couple of them that I was active in. But I did that to really build my own sort of network and networking skills. So it was sort of enlightened self-interest, as I like to say, back in the day. And it helped me with DeCosman Associates. So later on, as I've stepped into, corporate, more of the corporate world leadership roles, I just kept that as part of my, how I allocated time. These days I do a little bit less of it, so I'm a little more selective of the boards that I'm on and the roles that I take. And the advisory boards for the couple of local universities here in Chicago, those aren't big time commitments. It's a quarterly, events, and whether it's board meetings or meeting with students and the like. So, and it keeps me connected to not just the programs, but obviously the students in those programs, because we like to have our company, well known at least amongst the local tech and analytics community as well, for internships and recruiting and everything else as well. So, so I still do it all. It's not as much of the time, my time, as it has been in the past, but it's still important to me to stay involved.
Well, as time passes, as you've already alluded to, what we end up doing every day varies and changes substantially, early career to late career. At this point, if you wake up on a given day, you look at your calendar and you see what's on deck, what are the things that would make you say this is going to be a good day?
My answer might my answer might be a little surprising, maybe not for folks who are in my have similar role as me. Honestly, what gets me most excited is when I see some white space in my calendar,
Okay.
because it's unusual these days. I oversee, between technology and analytics here at Enova, I oversee about 375 folks across, you know, a dozen different teams. And my days are pretty packed with meetings. And so these days, what gets me most excited is an hour or two of open space where I can actually, you know, do some deep, you know, more deep work, thinking a little more strategically about, you know, what we need to do and about our teams as well. Yeah, other than that, I mean, I have our leadership team meetings every week with all my direct reports. I love those meetings. I have a really great set of leaders, and getting us all together in a room every week, you know, talking about our challenges and collaborating is super invigorating too. So yeah, those are the two. But yeah, white space these days is at a premium.
You know, I still wonder if the technology and such hasn't accelerated the trend away from white space. Like I don't know that our parents' generation struggled the same, but I know like when, you know, my years at Teradata, and most specifically at the end there, when you've got, you know, global teams, you've got to be coordinating and all these other things. You're ostensibly focused on strategy as a key part of your role, yet it's a struggle to ever find time to actually do it. So I think you're, you know, what you're describing is a very common scenario. I don't have the answer to how to fix it, but I do feel like that companies should value giving people like yourself white space, and like almost mandating that you get white space every week for a couple hours here and there, because I think it would make you a whole lot more effective and make anybody more effective at a job that involves big picture and strategy if they weren't on 10 hours of Zoom and Teams calls all day, right?
Right, right. So we have adopted, and we did this, it was pre-COVID, but we adopted a policy meeting free Friday afternoon. So we do have a policy of at noon on Fridays, no meetings. Now, you know, there can be, you know, if there's impromptu things can happen or come up that require, you know, you to hop on a meeting or something, but we try to enforce that, pretty strongly across the whole company, really, to give everyone that space at the end of the week to, you know, wrap up their open items, think about, you know, have some time to think about, you know, what they, maybe some longer term things as well. And so that's been helpful, been helpful as well for us. So we try to do it, takes discipline to stick to it, but that helps for sure. You know, the other thing is we do, so much of our work happens in Slack now, and not, you know, if I rewind 5 years, you know, most of us did most of our work in either in meetings or in email, and you can sort of decide when to, you know, you can set times to when you go through your email and sort of, you know, work your email inbox and the like. And now everything's shifted. And it really happened during COVID. Everything's shifted to Slack. And, you know, it's sort of instant messaging, and that's how we all get our work done now. And so it's a lot more immediate as well. So more interruption, more immediate interactions, which is good. I think it's good, but it definitely is different than, you know, how we sort of processed our work, you know, 5 years ago.
Well, I've kept you a while, so I'll finish with one question. We've talked a lot about your past and some of the stuff you're doing today. As you look forward the next couple of years, what are some of the trends that you see coming our way that you think are going to have the biggest impact on our industry?
The continued advancement of cloud data science tools and platforms, making more and more available, you know, the ability to process really, really large amounts of data, and use the most sophisticated algorithms, whether it's, straight up machine learning, algorithms, morphing into AI and the like. I think those are the big trends going forward. And that's what we're excited about. So we are, we're very focused on those advances as well here at Innova. The other thing that I'm excited about, and one that I think we've been, again, a little bit ahead of the curve on, is the growth of model operations and the importance of analytics teams owning their operations and infrastructure as well. So I think gone are the days of building models and handing off implementation and deployment to tech teams and others, and then, the analyst, it moves on to their next model. We've got a dedicated model operations team now that supports all of our infrastructure from pipelines for building to deployment, and then in production, execution, and monitoring. And that sits within our analytics org. So we own that now. It's we've doubled the size of that team over the last year. It's about 12 folks now. And that's the other area that's super exciting for me, to see other companies as they get more serious about data science, building out a model operation and owning a model operations infrastructure and team as well.
Well, thanks so much for your insights today. I think you provided some really good information and guidance throughout the conversation. So thanks for taking some time out of your day to talk to me, Joe. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, it was great, Bill. Great to catch up. And I look forward to talking down the road.